Mode of procedure? Covert. Efficient. Quick. Legal basis of such detentions. Defense of Pakistan rules. Permitting the pickup of undesirables who may be held incommunicado for a period of 6 months. Footnote. A renewable period of 6 months. Any questions? No? Good. You are Cutter, Unit 22. She-dog badges will be sewn to lapels. The acronym Cutter, of course, means bitch. And the man-dog? Cross-legged, blue-eyed, staring into space, he sits beneath a tree. Bodhi trees do not grow at this altitude. He makes do with his chinar. His nose, bulbous, cucumbery, tip blue with cold, and on his head a monk's tonsure, where once Mr. Zagalo's hand, and a mutilated finger whose missing segment fell at Masha Mirovich's feet after Glandy Keith had slammed, and stains on his face like a map.
Ikto!
He spits. His teeth are stained. Beetlejuice reddens his gums. A red stream of expectorated pan fluid leaves his lips to hit, with commendable accuracy, a beautifully wrought silver spittoon which sits before him on the ground. Ayuba, Shahid, Farouk are staring in amazement.
"Don't try to get it away from him,"
Sergeant Major Najmuddin indicates the spittoon.
"It sends him wild."
Ayuba begins,
"Sir, I thought you said three persons and a..."
But Najmuddin barks,
"No questions! Obedience without queries! This is your tracker. That's that. Dismiss!"
At that time, Ayuba and Farouk were 16 and a half years old. Shahid, who had lied about his age, was perhaps a year younger. Because they were so young and had not had time to acquire the type of memories which give men a firm hold on reality, such as memories of love or famine, the boy soldiers were highly susceptible to the influence of legends and gossip. Within 24 hours, in the course of mess hall conversations with other Cutter units, the man-dog had been fully mythologized.
"From a really important family, man."
"The idiot child. They put him in the army to make a man of him."
"Had a war accident in 65, yeah. Can't, won't remember a thing about it."
"Listen, I heard he was the brother of..."
"No, man, that's crazy. She is good, you know. So simple and holy. How would she leave her brother? Anyway, he refuses to talk about it."
"I heard one terrible thing. She hated him, man. That's why she..."
"No memory. Not interested in people. Lives like a dog."
"But the tracking business is true, all right. You see that nose on him? Yeah, man. He can follow any trail on earth."
"Through water, Baba. Across rocks. Such a tracker you never saw."
"And he can't feel a thing. That's right. Numb, I swear. Head to foot numb. You touch him, he wouldn't know. Only by smell he knows you're there."
"Must be the war wound." "But that spittoon, man, who knows? Carries it everywhere like a love token."
"I tell you, I'm glad it's you three. He gives me the creeps, yeah? It's those blue eyes."
"You know how they found out about his nose? He just wandered into a minefield, man. I swear, just picked his way through, like he could smell the damn mines."
"Oh, no, man. What are you talking? That's an old story. That was that first dog in the whole Cutter operation. That Bonzo man. Don't mix us up. Hey, you, Ayuba. You better watch your step. They say VIPs are keeping their eyes on him."
"Yeah, like I told you, Jamila Singer."
"Oh, keep your mouth shut. We all heard enough of your fairy tales."
Once Ayuba, Farouk, and Shahid had become reconciled to their strange, impassive tracker, it was after the incident at the latrines, they gave him the nickname of Buddha. Old man. Not just because he must have been 7 years their senior and had actually taken part in the 6 years ago war of 65, when the three boy soldiers weren't even in long pants, but because there hung around him an air of great antiquity. The Buddha was old before his time. Oh, fortunate ambiguity of transliteration. The Urdu word Buddha, meaning old man, is pronounced with the D's hard and plosive. But there is also Buddha, with soft-tongued D's, meaning he who achieved enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. Once upon a time, a prince, unable to bear the suffering of the world, became capable of not living in the world as well as living in it. He was present, but also absent.
His body was in one place, but his spirit was elsewhere. In ancient India, Gautama, the Buddha, sat enlightened under a tree at Gaya. In the deer park at Sarnath, he taught others to abstract themselves from worldly sorrows and achieve inner peace. And centuries later, Selim the Buddha sat under a different tree, unable to remember grief, numb as ice, wiped clean as a slate. With some embarrassment, I am forced to admit that amnesia is the kind of gimmick regularly used by our lurid filmmakers. Bowing my head slightly, I accept that my life has taken on yet again the tone of a Bombay talkie. But after all, leaving to one side the vexed issue of reincarnation, there is only a finite number of methods of achieving rebirth. So, apologizing for the melodrama, I must doggedly insist that he, had begun again, that after years of yearning for importance, he, or I, had been cleansed of the whole business, that after my vengeful abandonment by Jamila Singer, who wormed me into the army to get me out of her sight, I, or he, accepted the fate which was my repayment for love, and sat, uncomplaining, under a chinar tree, that, emptied of history, the Buddha learned the arts of submission, and did only what was required of him. To sum up, I became a citizen of Pakistan. It was arguably inevitable that during the months of training, the Buddha should begin to irritate Ayuba Balok. Perhaps it was because he chose to live apart from the soldiers, in a straw-lined ascetic stall at the far end of the kennel barracks, or because he was so often to be found sitting cross-legged under his tree, silver spittoon clutched in hand, with unfocused eyes and a foolish smile on his lips, as if he were actually happy that he'd lost his brains. What's more, Ayuba, the apostle of meat, may have found his tracker insufficiently virile, like a Brinjal man. I permit Ayuba to complain, I swear, a vegetable. We may also, taking the wider view, assert that irritation was in the air at the year's turn. Were not even General Yahya and Mr. Bhutto getting hot and bothered about the petulant insistence of Sheikh Mujib on his right to form the new government? The wretched Bengalis Awami League had won 160 out of a possible 162 East Wing seats. Mr. Bhutto's PPP had merely taken 81 Western constituencies. Yes, an irritating election. It is easy to imagine how irked Yahya and Bhutto, West Wingers both, must have been. And when even the mighty wax peevish, how is one to blame the small man? The irritation of Ayuba Balok, let us conclude, placed him in excellent, not to say exalted, company. On training manoeuvres, when Ayuba, Shahid, Farouk scrambled after the Buddha as he followed the faintest of trails across bush, rocks, streams, the three boys were obliged to admit his skill. But still Ayuba, tank-like, demanded, "Don't you remember? Really? Nothing? Allah! You don't feel bad? Somewhere you've maybe got mother, father, sister?" But the Buddha interrupted him gently. "Don't try and fill my head with that history. I am who I am. That's all there is." His accent was so pure. "Really classy, Lucknow-type Urdu. Wah, wah," Farouk said admiringly, that Ayuba Balok, who spoke coarsely like a tribesman, fell silent, and the three boys began to believe the rumours even more fervently. They were unwillingly fascinated by this man with his nose like a cucumber and his head which rejected memories, family's histories, which contained absolutely nothing except smells. "Like a bad egg that somebody sucked dry," Ayuba muttered to his companions, and then, returning to his central theme, added, "Allah, even his nose looks like a vegetable." Their uneasiness lingered. Did they sense in the Buddha's numbed blankness a trace of undesirability? For was not his rejection of past and family just the type of subversive behaviour they were dedicated to rooting out? The camp's officers, however, were deaf to Ayuba's request of, "Sir, can't we have just a real dog, sir?" So that Farouk, a born follower who had already adopted Ayuba as his leader and hero, cried, "What to do? With that guy's family contacts, some high-ups must have told the brigadier to put up with him. That's all." And, although none of the trio would have been able to express the idea, I suggest that at the deep foundations of their unease lay the fear of schizophrenia, of splitting, that was buried like an umbilical cord in every Pakistani heart. In those days, the country's east and west wings were separated by the unbridgeable land mass of India. But past and present, too, are divided by an unbridgeable gulf. Religion was the glue of Pakistan, holding the halves together, just as consciousness, the awareness of oneself as a homogeneous entity in time, a blend of past and present, is the glue of personality, holding together our then and our now. Enough philosophizing. What I am saying is that by abandoning consciousness, seceding from history, the Buddha was setting the worst of examples, and the example was followed by no less a personage than Sheikh Mujib when he led the East Wing into secession and declared it independent as Bangladesh. Yes, Ayuba, Shahid, Farooq were right to feel ill at ease, because even in those depths of my withdrawal from responsibility, I remained responsible through the workings of the metaphorical modes of connection for the belligerent events of 1971. But I must go back to my new companions so that I can relate the incident at the latrines. There was Ayuba, tank-like, who led the unit, and Farooq, who followed contentedly. The third youth, however, was a gloomier, more private type, and as such, closest to my heart. On his 15th birthday, Shahid Dar had lied about his age and enlisted. That day, his Punjabi sharecropper father had taken Shahid into a field and wept all over his new uniform. Old Dar told his son the meaning of his name, which was Martyr, and expressed the hope that he would prove worthy of it, and perhaps become the first of their family members to enter the perfumed garden, leaving behind this pitiful world in which a father could not hope to pay his debts and also feed his 19 children. The overwhelming power of names and the resulting approach of martyrdom had begun to prey heavily on Shahid's mind. In his dreams, he began to see his death, which took the form of a bright pomegranate and floated in mid-air behind him, following him everywhere, biding its time. The disturbing and somewhat unheroic vision of pomegranate death made Shahid an inward, unsmiling fellow. Inwardly, unsmilingly, Shahid observed various Khatri units being sent away from the camp into action, and became convinced that his time and the time of the pomegranate was very near. From departures of three men and a dog units in camouflage jeeps, he deduced a growing political crisis. It was February, and the irritations of the exalted were becoming daily more marked. Ayuba the tank, however, retained a local point of view. His irritation was also mounting, but its object was the Buddha. Ayuba had become infatuated with the only female in the camp, a skinny latrine cleaner who couldn't have been over 14 and whose nipples were only just beginning to push against her tattered shirt. A low type, certainly, but she was all that there was, and for a latrine cleaner she had very nice teeth and a pleasant line in saucy over-the-shoulder glances. Ayuba began to follow her around, and that was how he spied her going into the Buddha's straw-lined stall, and that was why he leaned a bicycle against the building and stood on the seat, and that was why he fell off, because he didn't like what he saw. Afterwards, he spoke to the latrine girl, grabbing her roughly by the arm. "Why do it with that crazy? Why, when I, Ayuba, am, could be?" And she replied that she liked the man-dog. "He's funny, says he can't feel anything. He rubs his hosepipe inside me, but can't even feel. But it's nice, and he tells that he likes my smell." The frankness of the urchin girl, the honesty of latrine cleaners, made Ayuba sick. He told her she had a soul composed of pig droppings, and a tongue caked with excrement also. And in the throes of his jealousy, he devised the prank of the jump leads, the trick of the electrified urinal. The location appealed to him. It had a certain poetic justice.
"Can't feel, huh?" Ayuba sneered to Farouk and Shahid. "Just wait on. I'll make him jump ashore."
On February 10th, when Yahya, Bhutto, and Mujib were refusing to engage in high-level talks, the Buddha felt the call of nature. A somewhat concerned Shahid and a gleeful Farouk loitered by the latrines, while Ayuba, who had used jump leads to attach the metal footplates of the urinals to the battery of a jeep, stood out of sight behind the latrine hut, beside the jeep whose motor was running. The Buddha appeared, with his eyes as dilated as a charistua's, and his gait of walking through a cloud. And as he floated into the latrine, Farouk called out, "Oh, hey, Ayuba Yara," and began to giggle. The child soldiers awaited the howl of mortified anguish, which would be the sign that their vacuous tracker had begun to piss, allowing electricity to mount the golden stream and sting him in his numb and urchin-rubbing hosepipe. But no shriek came. Farouk, feeling confused and cheated, began to frown. And as time went by, Shahid grew nervous and yelled over to Ayuba Bullock,
"You, Ayuba, what you doing, man?"
To which Ayuba the tank, "What do you think, yeah? I turned on the juice 5 minutes ago."
And now Shahid ran full tilt into the latrine to find the Buddha urinating away with an expression of foggy pleasure, emptying a bladder which must have been filling up for a fortnight, while the current passed up into him through his nether cucumber apparently unnoticed, so that he was filling up with electricity, and there was a blue crackle playing around the end of his gargantuan nose. And Shahid, who didn't have the courage to touch this impossible being, who could absorb electricity through his hosepipe, screamed,
"Disconnect, man, or you fry like an onion here!"
The Buddha emerged from the latrine, unconcerned, buttoning himself with his right hand, while the left hand held his silver spittoon. And the three child soldiers understood that it was really true. Allah, numb as ice and anesthetized against feelings as well as memories. For a week after the incident, the Buddha could not be touched without giving an electric shock, and not even the latrine girl could visit him in his stall. Curiously, after the jump lead business, Ayuba Bullock stopped resenting the Buddha and even began to treat him with respect. The canine unit was forged by that bizarre moment into a real team and was ready to venture forth against the evildoers of the earth. Ayuba the tank failed to give the Buddha a shock. But where the small man fails, the mighty triumph. When Yahya and Bhutto decided to make Sheikh Mujib jump, there were no mistakes. On March 15, 1971, 20 units of the Khatia Agency assembled in a hut with a blackboard. The garlanded features of the president gazed down upon 61 men and 19 dogs. Yahya Khan had just offered Mujib the olive branch of immediate talks with himself and Bhutto to resolve all irritations. But his portrait maintained an impeccable poker face, giving no clue to his true shocking intentions. While Brigadier Iskander rubbed knuckles on lapels, Sergeant Major Najmuddin issued orders. 61 men and 19 dogs were instructed to shed their uniforms, a tumultuous rustling in the hut, obeying without query. 19 individuals remove identifying collars from canine necks. The dogs, excellently trained, cock eyebrows, but refrain from giving voice. And the Buddha dutifully begins to undress. 5 dozen fellow humans follow his lead. 5 dozen stand to attention in a trice, shivering in the cold, beside neat piles of military berets, pants, shoes, shirts, and green pullovers with leather patches at the elbows. 61 men naked, except for imperfect underwear, are issued,
by Lala Moyne, the Batman, with army-approved mufti. Najmuddin barks a command. And then there they all are, some in lungis and kurtas, some in Pathan turbans. There are men in cheap rayon pants and men in striped clerk shirts. The Buddha is in dhoti and kameez. He is comfortable, but around him are soldiers squirming in ill-fitting plain clothes. This is, however, a military operation. No voice, human or canine, is raised in complaint. On March 15th, after obeying sartorial instructions, 20 Khatyo units were flown to Dhaka via Ceylon. Among them were Shahid Dar, Farooq Rashid, Ayuba Balok, and their Buddha. Also flying to the East Wing by this circuitous route were 60,000 of the West Wing's toughest troops. 60,000, like 61, were all in mufti. The general officer commanding, in a natty blue double-breasted suit, was Tikka Khan. The officer responsible for Dhaka, for its taming and eventual surrender, was called Tiger Niazi. He wore bush shirt, slacks, and a jaunty little trilby on his head. Via Ceylon we flew, 60,061 innocent airline passengers, avoiding overflying India, and thus losing our chance of watching from 20,000 feet the celebrations of Indira Gandhi's new Congress Party, which had won a landslide victory, 350 out of a possible 515 seats in the Lok Sabha, in another recent election. Indira, ignorant, unable to see her campaign slogan, Garibi Hatao, get rid of poverty, blazoned on walls and banners across the great diamond of India, we landed in Dhaka in the early spring and were driven in specially requisitioned civilian buses to a military camp. On this last stage of our journey, however, we were unable to avoid hearing a snatch of song issuing from some unseen gramophone. The song was called Amar Sona Bangla, Our Golden Bengal, author R. Tagore, and ran in part, "During spring, the fragrance of your mango groves maddens my heart with delight." However, none of us could understand Bengali, so we were protected against the insidious subversion of the lyric, although our feet did inadvertently tap, it must be admitted, to the tune. At first, Ayuba, Shahid, Farooq, and the Buddha were not told the name of the city to which they had come. Ayuba, envisaging the destruction of vegetarians, whispered, "Didn't I tell you? Now we'll show them. Spy stuff, man. Plain clothes and all. Up and at 'em. Number 22 unit. Kabang. Kadang. Kapow!" But we were not in India. Vegetarians were not our targets. And after days of cooling our heels, uniforms were issued to us once again. This second transfiguration took place on March 25th. On March 25th, Yahya and Bhutto abruptly broke off their talks with Mujib and returned to the West Wing. Night fell. Brigadier Iskander, followed by Najmuddin and Lala Moyne, who was staggering under the weight of 61 uniforms and 19 dog collars, burst into the Khatyo barracks. "Now, Najmuddin, snap to it! Actions, not words! 1, 2, double quick time!" Airline passengers donned uniforms and took up arms, while Brigadier Iskandar at last announced the purpose of our trip. "That Mujib," he revealed, "we'll give him what for, all right. We'll make him jump for sure." It was on March 25th, after the breakdown of the talks with Bhutto and Yahya, that Sheikh Mujib-ur-Rahman proclaimed the state of Bangladesh. Khatyo units emerged from barracks, piled into waiting jeeps, while, over the loudspeakers of the military base, the recorded voice of Jamila Singer was raised in patriotic hymns, and Ayuba, nudging the Buddha, "Listen, come on! Don't you recognize? Think, man, isn't that your own dear? Allah! This type is good for nothing but sniffing!" At midnight, could it, after all, have been at any other time? 60,000 crack troops also left their barracks. Passengers who had flown as civilians now pressed the starter buttons of tanks. Ayuba, Shahid, Farooq and the Buddha, however, were personally selected to accompany Brigadier Iskandar on the greatest adventure of the night. Yes, Padma, when Mujib was arrested, it was I who sniffed him out. They had provided me with one of his old shirts.
It's easy when you've got the smell.
Padma is almost beside herself with anguish.
But, mister, you didn't, can't have. How would you do such a thing?
Padma, I did. I have sworn to tell everything, to conceal no shred of the truth. But there are snail tracks on her face, and she must have an explanation. So, believe me, don't believe, but this is what it was like. I must reiterate that everything ended, everything began again, when a spittoon hit me on the back of the head. Salim, with his desperation for meaning, for worthy purpose, for genius like a shawl, had gone, would not return until a jungle snake, for the moment anyway, there is, was only the Buddha, who recognizes no singing voice as his relative, who remembers neither fathers nor mothers, for whom midnight holds no importance, who, sometime after a cleansing accident, awoke in a military hospital bed and accepted the army as his lot, who submits to the life in which he finds himself and does his duty, who follows orders, who lives both in the world and not in the world, who bows his head, who can track man or beast through streets or down rivers, who neither knows nor cares how, under whose auspices, as a favour to whom, at whose vengeful instigation, he was put into uniform, who is, in short, no more and no less than the accredited tracker of Katya Unit 22. But how convenient this amnesia is, how much it excuses. So permit me to criticize myself. The philosophy of acceptance to which the Buddha adhered had consequences no more and no less unfortunate than his previous lust for centrality. And here in Dhaka, those consequences were being revealed.
No, not true, my
Padma wails. The same denials have been made about most of what befell that night. Midnight, March 25th, 1971. Past the university, which was being shelled, the Buddha led troops to Sheikh Mujib's lair. Students and lecturers came running out of hostels. They were greeted by bullets, and mercurochromes stained the lawns. Sheikh Mujib, however, was not shot. Manacled, manhandled, he was led by Ayuba Balok to a waiting van. As once before, after the revolution of the pepper pots. But Mujib was not naked. He had on a pair of green and yellow striped pyjamas, and while we drove through city streets, Shahid looked out of windows and saw things that weren't, couldn't have been true. Soldiers entering women's hostels without knocking. Women dragged into the street were also entered, and again nobody troubled to knock. And newspaper offices burning with the dirty yellow-black smoke of cheap gutter newsprint, and the offices of trade unions smashed to the ground, and roadside ditches filling up with people who were not merely asleep. Bare chests were seen, and the hollow pimples of bullet holes. Ayuba, Shahid, Farouk watched in silence through moving windows as our boys, our soldiers for Allah, our worth 10 Babus Jawans, held Pakistan together by turning flamethrowers, machine guns, hand grenades on the city slums. By the time we brought Sheikh Mujib to the airport, where Ayuba stuck a pistol into his rump and pushed him onto an aircraft which flew him into West Wing captivity, the Buddha had closed his eyes. "Don't fill my head with all this history," he had once told Ayuba the tank. "I am what I am, and that's all there is." And Brigadier Iskander, rallying his troops, "Even now there are subversive elements to be rooted out." When thought becomes excessively painful, action is the finest remedy. Dog soldiers strain at the leash, and then, released, leap joyously to their work. Oh, wolfhound chases of undesirables! Oh, prolific seizings of professors and poets! Oh, unfortunate, shot while resisting arrests of Awami Leaguers and fashion correspondents! Dogs of war cry havoc in the city. But although tracker dogs are tireless, soldiers are weaker. Farouk, Shahid, Ayuba take turns at vomiting as their nostrils are assailed by the stench of burning slums. The Buddha, in whose nose the stench spawns images of searing vividness,
continues merely to do his job. Nose them out. Leave the rest to the soldier boys. Cut your units stalk the smouldering wreck of the city. No undesirable is safe tonight. No hiding place impregnable. Bloodhounds track the fleeing enemies of national unity. Wolfhounds, not to be outdone, sink fierce teeth into their prey. How many arrests? 10? 420? 1,001? Did our own number 22 unit make that night? How many intellectual, lily-livered Dakans hid behind women's saris and had to be yanked into the streets? How often did Brigadier Iskander smell this? That's the stink of subversion. Unleash the warhounds of unity. There are things which took place on the night of March 25th which must remain permanently in a state of confusion. Futility of statistics. During 1971, 10 million refugees fled across the borders of East Pakistan, Bangladesh, into India. But 10 million, like all numbers larger than 1,001, refuses to be understood. Comparisons do not help. The biggest migration in the history of the human race? Meaningless. Bigger than Exodus? Larger than the partition crowds? The many-headed monster poured into India. On the border, Indian soldiers trained the guerrillas known as Mukti Bahini. In Dhaka, Tiger Niazi ruled the roost. And Ayuba, Shahid, Farooq, our boys in green? How did they take to battling against fellow meat-eaters? Did they mutiny? Were officers Iskandar, Najmuddin, even Lala Moyn riddled with nauseated bullets? They were not. Innocence had been lost. But despite a new grimness about the eyes, despite the irrevocable loss of certainty, despite the eroding of moral absolutes, the unit went on with its work. The Buddha was not the only one who did as he was told. While somewhere high above the struggle, the voice of Jamila Singer fought anonymous voices singing the lyrics of R. Tagore. My life passes in the shady village homes filled with rice from your fields. They madden my heart with delight. Their hearts maddened, but not with delight. Ayuba and company followed orders. The Buddha followed scent trails. Into the heart of the city, which has turned violent, maddened, blood-soaked as the West Wing soldiers react badly to their knowledge of wrongdoing, goes number 22 unit. Through the blackened streets, the Buddha concentrates on the ground, sniffing out trails, ignoring the ground-level chaos of cigarette packs, cow dung, fallen bicycles, abandoned shoes, and then, on other assignments, out into the countryside, where entire villages are being burned owing to their collective responsibility for harbouring Mukti Bahini. The Buddha and three boys track down minor Awami League officials and well-known communist types. Past migrating villages with bundled possessions on their heads, past torn-up railway tracks and burnt-out trees, and always, as though some invisible force were directing their footsteps, drawing them into a darker heart of madness, their mission send them south, 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 always nearer to the sea, to the mouths of the Ganges and the sea. And at last, who were they following then? Did names matter any more? They were given a quarry whose skills must have been the equal and opposite of the Buddha's own. Otherwise, why did it take so long to catch him? At last, unable to escape their training, pursue relentlessly, arrest remorselessly, they are in the midst of a mission without an end, pursuing a foe who endlessly eludes them. But they cannot report back to base empty-handed. And on they go, south, 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 drawn by the eternally receding scent trail, and perhaps by something more, because in my life, fate has never been unwilling to lend a hand. They have commandeered a boat, because the Buddha said the trail led down the river. Hungry, unslept, exhausted in a universe of abandoned rice paddies, they row after their unseen prey. Down the great brown river they go, until the war is too far away to remember, but still the scent leads them on. The river here has a familiar name, Padma. but the name is a local deception. In reality, the river is still her, the Mother Water, Goddess Ganga, streaming down to earth through Shiva's hair. The Buddha has not spoken for days. He just points. There, that way, and on they go. South, south, south to the sea. A nameless morning. Ayuba, Shahid, Farooq, awaking in the boat of their absurd pursuit, moored by the bank of Padma Ganga, to find him gone.
Allah, Allah! Farooq yelps. Grab your ears and pray for pity. He's brought us to this drowned place and run off. It's all your fault. You, Ayuba, that trick with the jump leads. And this is his revenge.
The sun climbing. Strange alien birds in the sky. Hunger and fear like mice in their bellies. And what if the Mukti Bahini? Parents are invoked. Shahid has dreamed his pomegranate dream. Despair lapping at the edges of the boat, and in the distance, near the horizon, an impossible, endless, huge green wall, stretching right and left to the ends of the earth. Unspoken fear. How can it be? How can what we are seeing be true? Who builds walls across the world? And then, Ayuba,
look, look, Allah!
Because coming towards them, across the rice paddies, is a bizarre slow-motion chase. First, the Buddha with that cucumber nose. You could spot it a mile off. And following him, splashing through paddies, a gesticulating peasant with a scythe. Father Time, enraged. While running along a dike, a woman with a sari caught up between her legs, hair loose, voice pleading, screaming, while the scythed avenger stumbles through drowned rice, covered from head to foot in water and mud. Ayuba roars with nervous relief.
The old billy goat couldn't keep his hands off the local women. Come on, Buddha, don't let him catch you. He'll slice off both your cucumbers.
And Farooq, but then what? And now Ayuba the tank is pulling a pistol out of its holster. Ayuba aiming, both hands held out in front, trying not to shake. Ayuba squeezing. A scythe curves up into the air, and slowly, slowly the arms of a peasant rise up as though in prayer. Knees kneel in paddy water. A face plunges below the water level to touch its forehead to the earth. On the dike, a woman wailing, and Ayuba tells the Buddha,
next time, I'll shoot you instead.
Ayuba, the tank, shaking like a leaf, and Time lies dead in a rice paddy. But there is still the meaningless chase, the enemy who will never be seen, and the Buddha. Go that way, and the four of them row on, south, south, south. They have murdered the hours and forgotten the date. They no longer know if they are chasing after or running from. But whichever it is that pushes them is bringing them closer, closer to the impossible green wall. That way, the Buddha insists, and then they are inside it. The jungle which is so thick that history has hardly ever found the way in. The Sundarbans, it swallows them up. In the Sundarbans. I'll own up. There was no last elusive quarry, driving us south, south, south. To all my readers, I should like to make this naked-breasted admission. While Ayuba, Shahid, Farooq were unable to distinguish between chasing after and running from, the Buddha knew what he was doing. Although I am well aware that I am providing any future commentators or venom-quilled critics, to whom I say twice before, I've been subjected to snake poison on both occasions, I prove stronger than venines, with yet more ammunition, through admission of guilt, revelation of moral turpitude, proof of cowardice, I'm bound to say that he, the Buddha, finally incapable of continuing in the submissive performance of his duty, took to his heels and fled. Infected by the soul-chewing maggots of pessimism, futility, shame, he deserted into the historyless anonymity of rainforests, dragging three children in his wake. What I hope to immortalize in pickles as well as words, that condition of the spirit in which the consequences of acceptance could not be denied, in which an overdose of reality gave birth to a miasmic longing for flight into the safety of dreams, but the jungle, like all refuges, was entirely other, was both less and more than he had expected. "I am glad," my Padma says. "I am happy you ran away." But I insist, not I, he. He, the Buddha, who until the snake would remain not Salim, who, in spite of running from, was still separated from his past, although he clutched in his limpet fist a certain silver spittoon. The jungle closed behind them like a tomb, and after hours of increasingly weary but also frenzied rowing through incomprehensibly labyrinthine saltwater channels overtowered by the cathedral-arching trees, Ayuba, Shahid, Farouk were hopelessly lost. They turned time and again to the Buddha, who pointed that way and then down there. But although they rode feverishly, ignoring fatigue, it seems as if the possibility of ever leaving this place receded before them like the lantern of a ghost, until at length they rounded on their supposedly infallible tracker and perhaps saw some small light of shame or relief glowing in his habitually milky blue eyes. And now Farouk whispered in the sepulchral greenness of the forest, "You don't know. You're just saying anything." The Buddha remained silent, but in his silence they read their fate. And now that he was convinced that the jungle had swallowed them the way a toad gulps down a mosquito, now that he was sure he would never see the sun again, Ayuba Balok, Ayuba the tank himself, broke down utterly and wept like a monsoon. The incongruous spectacle of this huge figure with a crew cut blubbering like a baby served to detach Farouk and Shahid from their senses, so that Farouk almost upset the boat by attacking the Buddha, who mildly bore all the fist blows which rained down on his chest, shoulders, arms, until Shahid pulled Farouk down for the sake of safety. Ayuba Balok cried without stopping for 3 entire hours, or days, or weeks, until the rain began and made his tears unnecessary, and Shahid Dar heard himself saying, "Now look what you've started, man, with your crying," proving that they were already beginning to succumb to the logic of the jungle. And that was only the start of it. Because as the mystery of evening compounded the unreality of the trees, the sundarbans began to grow in the rain. At first they were so busy bailing out their boat that they did not notice, also, the water level was rising, which may have confused them. But in the last light there could be no doubt that the jungle was gaining in size, power, and ferocity. The huge stilt roots of vast ancient mangrove trees could be seen snaking about thirstily in the dusk, sucking in the rain and becoming thicker than elephants' trunks, while the mangroves themselves were getting so tall that, as Shahid Dar said afterwards, the birds at the top must have been able to sing to God. The leaves in the heights of the great nipper palms began to spread like immense green-cupped hands, swelling in the nocturnal downpour until the entire forest seemed to be thatched. And then the nipper fruits began to fall. They were larger than any coconuts on earth and gathered speed alarmingly as they fell from dizzying heights to explode like bombs in the water. Rainwater was filling their boat. They had only their soft green caps and an old ghee tin to bail with. And as night fell and the nipper fruits bombed them from the air, Shahid Dar said, "Nothing else to do. We must land." Although his thoughts were full of his pomegranate dream, and it crossed his mind that this might be where it came true, even if the fruits were different here. While Ayuba sat in a red-eyed funk and Farouk seemed destroyed by his hero's disintegration, while the Buddha remained silent and bowed his head, Shahid alone remained capable of thought, because although he was drenched and worn out and the night jungle screeched around him, his head became partly clear whenever he thought about the pomegranate of his death. So it was Shahid who ordered us, them, to row our, their, sinking boat to shore. A nipper fruit missed the boat by an inch and a half, creating such turbulence in the water that they capsized. They struggled ashore in the dark, holding guns, oilskins, guillotine above their heads, pulled the boat up after themselves, and past caring about bombarding nipper palms and snaking mangroves, fell into their sodden craft and slept. When they awoke, soaking, shivering in spite of the heat, the rain had become a heavy drizzle. They found their bodies covered in 3-inch-long leeches, which were almost entirely colourless, owing to the absence of direct sunlight, but which had now turned bright red because they were full of blood, and which, one by one, exploded on the bodies of the 4 human beings, being too greedy to stop sucking when they were full. Blood trickled down legs and onto the forest floor. The jungle sucked it in and knew what they were like. When the falling nipper fruit smashed on the jungle floor, they too exuded a liquid the colour of blood, a red milk which was immediately covered in a million insects, including giant flies as transparent as the leeches. The flies too reddened as they filled up with the milk of the fruit. All through the night, it seemed, the Sundarbans had continued to grow. Tallest of all were the Sundri trees, which had given their name to the jungle, trees high enough to block out even the faintest hope of sun. The 4 of us, them, climbed out of the boat, and only when they set foot on a hard, bare soil, crawling with pale pink scorpions and a seething mass of dun-coloured earthworms, did they remember their hunger and thirst. Rainwater poured off leaves all around them, and they turned their mouths up to the roof of the jungle and drank. But perhaps because the water came to them by way of sundry leaves and mangrove branches and nipper fronds, it acquired on its journey something of the insanity of the jungle, so that as they drank, they fell deeper and deeper into the thraldom of that livid green world where the birds had voices like creaking wood and all the snakes were blind. In the turbid, miasmic state of mind which the jungle induced, they prepared their first meal, a combination of nipper fruits and mashed earthworms, which inflicted on them all a diarrhea so violent that they forced themselves to examine the excrement in case their intestines had fallen out in the mess. Farouk said, "We're going to die." But Shahid was possessed by a powerful lust for survival, because, having recovered from the doubts of the night, he had become convinced that this was not how he was supposed to go. Lost in the rainforest, and aware that the lessening of the monsoon was only a temporary respite, Shahid decided that there was little point in attempting to find a way out when, at any moment, the returning monsoon might sink their inadequate craft. Under his instructions, a shelter was constructed from oilskins and palm fronds. Shahid said, "As long as we stick to fruit, we can survive." They had all long ago forgotten the purpose of their journey, the chase which had begun far away in the real world, acquired in the altered light of the Sundarbans a quality of absurd fantasy, which enabled them to dismiss it once and for all. So it was that Ayuba, Shahid, Farouk, and the Buddha surrendered themselves to the terrible phantasms of the dream forest. The days passed, dissolving into each other under the force of the returning rain, and despite chills, fevers, diarrhea, they stayed alive, improving their shelter by pulling down the lower branches of sundries and mangroves, drinking the red milk of nipper fruits, acquiring the skills of survival, such as the power of strangling snakes and throwing sharpened sticks so accurately that they speared multicoloured birds through their gizzards. But one night, Ayuba awoke in the dark to find the translucent figure of a peasant with a bullet hole in his heart and a scythe in his hand staring mournfully down at him. And as he struggled to get out of the boat, which they had pulled in under the cover of their primitive shelter, the peasant leaked a colourless fluid which flowed out of the hole in his heart and onto Ayuba's gun arm. The next morning, Ayuba's right arm refused to move. It hung rigidly by his side, as if it had been set in plaster. Although Farouk Rashid offered help and sympathy, it was no use. The arm was held immovably in the invisible fluid of the ghost. After this first apparition, they fell into a state of mind in which they would have believed the forest capable of anything. Each night it sent them new punishments. The accusing eyes of the wives of men they had tracked down and seized, the screaming and monkey gibbering of children left fatherless by their work. And in this first time, the time of punishment, even the impassive Buddha, with his citified voice, was obliged to confess that he, too, had taken to waking up at night to find the forest closing in upon him like a vice, so that he felt unable to breathe. When it had punished them enough, when they were all trembling shadows of the people they had once been, the jungle permitted them the double-edged luxury of nostalgia. One night, Ayuba, who was regressing towards infancy faster than any of them and had begun to suck his one movable thumb, saw his mother looking down at him, offering him the delicate rice-based sweets of her love. But at the same moment, as he reached out for the laddus, she scurried away, and he saw her climb a giant sundri tree to sit swinging from a high branch by her tail. A white wraith-like monkey, with the face of his mother, visited Ayuba night after night, so that after a time he was obliged to remember more about her than her sweets. How she had liked to sit among the boxes of her dowry, as though she too was simply some sort of thing, simply one of the gifts her father gave to her husband. In the heart of the Sundarbans, Ayuba Balak understood his mother for the first time and stopped sucking his thumb. Farouk Rashid, too, was given a vision. At dusk one day, he thought he saw his brother running wildly through the forest and became convinced that his father had died. He remembered a forgotten day when his peasant father had told him and his fleet-footed brother that the local landlord, who lent money at 300%, had agreed to buy his soul in return for the latest loan.
"When I die," old Rashid told Farouk's brother, "you must open your mouth, and my spirit will fly inside it. Then run, 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 because the zamindar will be after you."
Farouk, who had also started regressing alarmingly, found in the knowledge of his father's death and the flight of his brother the strength to give up the childish habits which the jungle had at first recreated in him. He stopped crying when he was hungry and asking, "Why?" Shahid Dar, too, was visited by a monkey with the face of an ancestor. But all he saw was a father who had instructed him to earn his name. This, however, also helped to restore in him the sense of responsibility which the just following orders requirements of war had sapped. So it seemed that the magical jungle, having tormented them with their misdeeds, was leading them by the hand towards a new adulthood. And flitting through the night forest went the wraiths of their hopes. These, however, they were unable to see clearly or to grasp. The Buddha, however, was not granted nostalgia at first. He had taken to sitting cross-legged under a sundri tree. His eyes and mind seemed empty, and at night he no longer awoke. But finally the forest found a way through to him. One afternoon, when rain pounded down on the trees and boiled off them as steam, Ayuba Shahid Farouk saw the Buddha sitting under his tree while a blind, translucent serpent bit and poured venom into his heel. Shahid Dar crushed the serpent's head with a stick. The Buddha, who was head to foot numb, seemed not to have noticed. His eyes were closed. After this, the boy soldiers waited for the man-dog to die. But I was stronger than the snake poison. For 2 days he became as rigid as a tree, and his eyes crossed so that he saw the world in mirror image, with the right side on the left. At last he relaxed, and the look of milky abstraction was no longer in his eyes. I was rejoined to the past, jolted into unity by snake poison. And it began to pour out through the Buddha's lips. As his eyes returned to normal, his words flowed so freely that they seemed to be an aspect of the monsoon.
The child soldiers listened, spellbound, to the stories issuing from his mouth, beginning with a birth at midnight and continuing unstoppably, because he was reclaiming everything, all of it, all lost histories, all the myriad complex processes that go to make a man. Open-mouthed, unable to tear themselves away, the child soldiers drank his life like leaf-tainted water as he spoke of bedwetting cousins, revolutionary pepper pots, the perfect voice of a sister. Ayuba Shahid Farouk would have, once upon a time, given anything to know that those rumours had been true. But in the Sundarbans, they didn't even cry out. And rushing on, to late flowering love, and Jamila in a bedroom in a shaft of light, now Shahid did murmur. So that's why, when he confessed, after that she couldn't stand to be near. But the Buddha continues, and it becomes apparent that he is struggling to recall something particular, something which refuses to return, which obstinately eludes him, so that he gets to the end without finding it, and remains frowning and unsatisfied, even after he has recounted a holy war and revealed what fell from the sky. There was a silence, and then Farouk Rashid said, "So much yahar inside one person, so many bad things. No wonder he kept his mouth shut. You see, Padma, I have told this story before. But what refused to return? What, despite the liberating venom of a colourless serpent, failed to emerge from my lips? Padma, the Buddha had forgotten his name. To be precise, his first name. And still it went on raining, the water level rising daily, until it became clear that they would have to move deeper into the jungle in search of higher ground. The rain was too heavy for the boat to be of use, so, still following Shahid's instructions, Ayuba, Farouk and the Buddha pulled it far away from the encroaching bank, tied mooring rope around Sundri trunk, and covered their craft with leaves, after which, having no option, they moved even further into the dense uncertainty of the jungle. Now, once again, the Sundarbans changed its nature. Once again, Ayuba Shahid Farouk found their ears filled with the lamentations of families from whose bosom they had torn what once centuries ago they had termed undesirable elements. They rushed wildly forward into the jungle to escape from the accusing, painful voices of their victims, and at night the ghostly monkeys gathered in the trees and sang the words of "Our Golden Bengal. Oh, mother, I am poor, but what little I have I lay at thy feet, and it maddens my heart with delight." Unable to escape from the unbearable torture of the unceasing voices, incapable of bearing for a moment longer the burden of shame, which was now greatly increased by their jungle-learned sense of responsibility, the three boy soldiers were moved at last to take desperate measures. Shahid Dar stooped down and picked up two handfuls of rain-heavy jungle mud. In the throes of that awful hallucination, he thrust the treacherous mud of the rainforest into his ears, and after him, Ayuba Balak and Farouk Rashid stopped their ears also with mud. Only the Buddha left his ears, one good, one already bad, unstopped. As though he alone were willing to bear the retribution of the jungle, as though he were bowing his head before the inevitability of his guilt. The mud of the dream forest, which no doubt also contained the concealed translucency of jungle insects and the devilry of bright orange bird droppings, infected the ears of the three boy soldiers and made them all as deaf as posts, so that although they were spared the sing-song accusations of the jungle, they were now obliged to converse in a rudimentary form of sign language. They seemed, however, to prefer their diseased deafness to the unpalatable secrets which the Sundri leaves had whispered in their ears. At last the voices stopped, though by now only the Buddha, with his one good ear, could hear them. At last, when the four wanderers were near the point of panic, the jungle brought them through a curtain of tree beards and showed them a sight so lovely that it brought lumps to their throats. Even the Buddha seemed to tighten his grip on his spittoon, With one good ear between the four of them, they advanced into a glade filled with the gentle melodies of songbirds, in whose center stood a monumental Hindu temple, carved in forgotten centuries out of a single immense crag of rock. Its walls danced with friezes of men and women, who were depicted coupling in postures of unsurpassable athleticism and sometimes of highly comic absurdity. The quartet moved towards this miracle with disbelieving steps. Inside, they found, at long last, some respite from the endless monsoon, and also the towering statue of a black dancing goddess, whom the boy soldiers from Pakistan could not name. But the Buddha knew she was Kali, fecund and awful, with the remnants of gold paint on her teeth. The four travellers lay down at her feet and fell into a rain-free sleep, which ended at what could have been midnight, when they awoke simultaneously to find themselves being smiled upon by four young girls of a beauty which was beyond speech. Shahid, who recalled the four houris awaiting him in the camphor garden, thought at first that he had died in the night. But the houris looked real enough, and their saris, under which they wore nothing at all, were torn and stained by the jungle. Now, as eight eyes stared into eight, saris were unwound and placed neatly folded on the ground, after which the naked and identical daughters of the forest came to them. Eight arms were twined with eight. Eight legs were linked with eight legs more. Below the statue of multi-limbed Kali, the travellers abandoned themselves to caresses which felt real enough, to kisses and love bites which were soft and painful, to scratches which left marks, and they realised that this was what they had needed, what they had longed for without knowing it, that having passed through the childish regressions and childlike sorrows of their earliest jungle days, having survived the onset of memory and responsibility and the greater pains of renewed accusations, they were leaving infancy behind forever, and then, forgetting reasons and implications and deafness, forgetting everything, they gave themselves to the four identical beauties without a single thought in their heads. After that night, they were unable to tear themselves away from the temple, except to forage for food, and every night the soft women of their most contented dreams returned in silence, never speaking, always neat and tidy with their saris, and invariably bringing the lost quartet to an incredible united peak of delight. None of them knew how long this period lasted, because in the Sundarbans, time followed unknown laws. But at last the day came when they looked at each other and realized they were becoming transparent, that it was possible to see through their bodies, not clearly as yet, but cloudily, like staring through mango juice. In their alarm, they understood that this was the last and worst of the jungle's tricks, that by giving them their heart's desire, it was fooling them into using up their dreams, so that as their dream life seeped out of them, they became as hollow and translucent as glass. The Buddha saw now that the colourlessness of insects and leeches and snakes might have more to do with the depredations worked on their insectly, leechy, snakish imaginations than with the absence of sunlight. Awakened as if for the first time by the shock of translucency, they looked at the temple with new eyes, seeing the great gaping cracks in the solid rock, realising that vast segments could come detached and crash down upon them at any moment.